Hello there, you're listening to The Naked Pravda. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, Meduza's English language managing editor, and I'm recovering from my second Pfizer shot as we speak. I got it about 24 hours ago. So if I just start dozing off in the middle of this narration, you'll know why. Because I'm feeling a little bit loopy, but I guess that's how you know it's working. Anyway, as I said, I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, and this month has been a busy one, which is why today's podcast episode features three guests, each discussing a separate issue, all of which are pegged to some of the things that have been going on in the last few days. On the world stage, the most excitement took place in Russia's unraveling relations with the Czech Republic. Moscow and Prague have been busy booting out each other's diplomats and suspected spies. Currently, the total expulsion count is something like 80 officials, most of them Russian. The whole fiasco kicked off on April 17th, when the Czech authorities accused Russian military intelligence of destroying some ammunition depots in 2014 in explosions that killed two people. 3 days before that bombshell drop, police officers in Moscow raided the newsroom of the student journal Doxa, as well as the homes of four editors, who are now under house arrest pending felony charges for sharing a video on social media this January that urged Russian students not to give in to university administrators who were trying to scare students out of protesting in support of Alexei Navalny. Russia's federal media regulator forced the journal to unpublish the video, arguing that it incited young people to join illegal demonstrations. Doxa's editors complied with the takedown orders, but challenged the decision in court. And one of the biggest domestic news stories in Russia in the last week was Alexei Navalny's hunger strike and his health status in prison. As I sat down to edit and record today's episode, Navalny actually announced that he's ended the hunger strike, following protests in dozens of cities across Russia this Wednesday, a day after he was apparently examined at a civilian hospital. Navalny's team of private doctors is still calling for his long-term transfer to a civilian facility and demanding direct access to their patient, but they asked Navalny to call off the hunger strike on Thursday, and he did so a day later on Friday. He's still in prison, though, of course. On this podcast, I usually try to zero in on a single news story, but this week was just too jam-packed to accommodate that approach. So again, just to orient you here, our three stories today are the Russian spy operation in the Czech Republic, the crackdown on the student journal Doxa, and living conditions behind bars in Russia today. Investigative reporters at Bellingcat reported this week that Colonel General Andrei Avaryanov, a senior deputy to the head of the GRU, Russian military intelligence, personally supervised at least six Russian military intelligence operatives in the explosion of a Czech munitions depot on October 15th, 2014. Avaryanov traveled to Europe undercover using a pretty stupid alias, it turns out, in one of only two known occasions when he directly set foot in the field for one of these secret ops. To learn more about these events, I spoke to Bellingcat Research and Training Director Eric Toller. Why is it so important that this Colonel General Andrei Avaryanov personally supervised this operation? And like, why on earth would he need to like be on the ground there for this sort of thing? Because, you know, reading your report, I'm like, wow, this is really intense that this chief guy went out there to supervise it. But then it's like, why the f*** would he go do something like that?
Yeah, no, it's weird. Yeah, it's a good question. So when we look at other things, like other big operations that have gone down, you know, like the Skripal poisoning and the, you know, the Montenegro thing, all the hackings. No, I guess he doesn't need to be around for the hacking. It's more, but this is the only one we can find. There's another in 2015. We're not totally different thing. We're not sure about, but this is really the only one Avaryanov is actually gone to, like physically, like been present for, because we have, at least that we know of, we have his travel records under his name and also his pseudonym, which is kind of funny. So this guy under Avaryanov, he's the kind of the big boss of this GRU unit you've been hearing about. So he's all the unit does all the poisonings and hackings and all the nasty stuff. It's unit number 29155. It's based out of Northwest Moscow. And he's kind of the big boss in charge of this. He's kind of he directly reports to the head of the GRU most often. Sometimes we even have some, because we've got his phone calls. He's even called like Lavrov and stuff too. So he's pretty high up. And he travels under a fake identity of Avaryanov. So his real name is Avaryanov and his fake ID is Avaryanov. But the only difference is the first letter is an O instead of an A. And there's no Miyakiznak. So in his real name, it's Avaryanov with an A, then a Miyakiznak after the R. And for his fake identity, he doesn't have that. So this is the only trip that we really know about that he's actually been around for. And it's strange, but there's six people who went to this mission that we know of. So, of course, the famous Skripal poisoners, Mishkin and Chupika, you know, guys who did the RT interview. And you have two guys who flew into Budapest who on a diplomatic passport. So this guy, he flew in, this guy named Kampinos, I don't know Greek, I don't know how to pronounce it. He's a Russian guy who is a diplomat, and he flew in a diplomatic passport with a diplomatic pouch. And he also did the same thing with the Skripal poisoning too, shortly before then. He also flew into London with a diplomatic pouch too. So this is the bag man.
Are they putting the poison and the explosives in the diplomatic pouch, or what's going on?
Maybe.
Possibly. That's possible. Right? Is it actually possible?
Maybe, yeah. Or the detonators or something, right? Maybe not the actual explosive parts. I don't know how bombs work very well. But we think maybe the detonator or something. And it's very possible that the Novichok came with him too, because again, diplomatic passport, you can sneak it in.
Yeah. Right. So you think they're that's the logical reason for using the diplomatic cover, is that they're actually sneaking contraband?
Yeah. I mean, we obviously don't. I mean, we don't have a copy of his pouch or whatever. Right. There's only so much we can get with data, with phone data and travel records. We can't obviously the contents of the pouch won't be known. But I mean, yeah, this is a diplomatic guy who's working at the GRU, and he flew into Budapest shortly before, because Budapest, Vienna, and Prague are all roughly equidistant from the arms depot that exploded in northeast Czechia. And he did this. He also flew into London very shortly before the Skripal poisoning. So there's clearly there's a pattern here. This guy kind of appearing shortly before bad things that are going on.
I had a sourcing question. I don't know if you're able to answer, but in the report you mentioned that Major General Denis Sergeyev and Lieutenant Colonel Yegor Gordienko, they fly into Switzerland, and then they rent a car and they put about 340 miles on it. How do you know that? Are there car rental records available on the black market?
Yes and no, because there's a hacker group called Black Mirror that got into his inbox. They do a lot of GRU hacking stuff.
Do they deliberately target the GRU as a political kind of thing?
Yeah, it seems like it. Huh. Yeah, they previously got. We wrote a piece a few months ago, about this guy that they hacked. He's a senior GRU guy, and his inbox was leaked entirety. Yep. And they announced this in their Telegram, and we got a copy of it and everything. It had lots of fun stuff in there, including some MiG-17 related stuff. And they also got this guy, this Gordienko guy, and within his phone, his inbox were car receipts for a car rental. And we've been sitting on some of this stuff for a while. We had the phone records and the travel records and some these leaked inboxes and stuff, but we never really knew how they pieced together. We knew Averyanov flew into Vienna, shortly before this explosion, but we didn't really think to look into this explosion, because this is in Vienna, and that was outside of Czechia. But now that we kind of the Czech police came out about this explosion, now we kind of realize this is all this random, seemingly random stuff all going into Central Europe, actually is all connected.
Do you have any sense of how they hacked the GRU people? Is it phishing, or is it? Who knows?
Probably. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm guessing it's probably phishing, because when you look at some of these guys, just for example, the FBI put out its most wanted stuff for some of those GRU hacker guys who were involved in DNC hack and the Olympic boat, Olympic doping hack and whatever. They include their names and phone number, not their phone numbers, but their names, date of birth, whatever. And it's not very hard to figure out what their email is, because, you just plug in and do some Telegram bots or check VK or whatever, and you can check what their emails are, because it's connected to their public identity. And you can plug some of those emails into, there's these sites, there's one called IntelX, there's another one called Ghost Project. There's a bunch of these sites that collect leaked credentials. And the idea behind them is, if you're an InfoSec, info security researcher, for example, I'm the IT official at Mellencat, and I tell one of these sites, you can pay for your service. Every time there's a new data breach, a new leak, alert me. Every time there's at Mellencat.com email address, give me an alert that there is a data leak, so I can tell the employee to change your password, right? But you can also use these the other way around. You can actually input some of these emails, and it'll tell you what their password is, their linked credentials, whatever. And even some of these, big bad hackers who hack the DNC and all this stuff, if you put in some of their Yandex and Mail.ru and Rumbler emails, which they use, you can see their passwords on there that are just right there. And one GRU hacker used a password 1234567 89 for his password.
That's the same password I have in my luggage.
This is a big elite hacker, and they use these very easy to guess passwords. So we don't know exactly what they did. They didn't really disclose their methods, but I would definitely strongly suspect that they just found their reused, recycled passwords, because these guys aren't geniuses. Even though they do all this nasty stuff, they aren't exactly geniuses when it comes to things like account security, operational security, or whatever.
Mishkin and Chipiga, I guess when they were in Prague, and this is in October 2014, around the time of just before the explosions, they apparently posted something on social media. And I was wondering, is that just another example of kind of them being stupid, or was that supposed to be part of their cover story? Because I know they were supposed to be there as arms purchasers or whatever, dealers, I guess, posing as that, right? So why on earth are they putting selfies on Instagram or wherever it was.
Yeah, this is kind of like the double-sided nature of these guys. Like, on one hand, you think, like, you know, they're these slick spies, they're poisoning people, they're blowing stuff up, they're doing all this crazy stuff, but they're also, like, kind of idiots, too. So they were on, you know, officially, these Mishkin and Chibiga have, I guess, three identities. They have Mishkin and Chibiga, their real identities. They have Bashirov and Petrov, which is their things they got their visas in, like when they went, you know, to the UK and to the EU, this is their visa name. And they also have a third fake identity with fake passports, because the other ones are real passports issued by the Russians. So like, it's fake identity, but a real passport. They also have a third identity with fake passports, fake Tajik and fake Moldovan passports, with a third fake identity. And so they traveled to Czechia under their fake identities, real passports, you know, Petrov and Bashirov. But then they were going to go to visit this arms depot under the fake ID of these Tajik and Moldovan arms dealers or arms manufacturers or whatever. And so
they show up at the arms depot and they're like, here's our ID, but they're showing fake
passports. They supposedly never showed up. Actually, showed up officially. Oh, right. You know, clearly they were there or tried to get there, but they never officially showed up or checked in, but they, you know, got information, whatever. It's also, this is just a side detail, but also BBC has noted that the person who emailed to arrange this, like, I have two of my people coming in to visit the depot, they're, you know, here are their IDs or whatever, was a guy whose name was Andrei O, and who was from Russia, which is Andrei Avryanov, who was the big boss. So this guy, apparently, he actually set up the meet, right, under his fake ID for whatever. Anyways, so they're officially, you know, visiting as arms dealers or whatever to visit this depot, but also on the 11th, which is the day they got in there, who's the, you know, with the RT interviews, there's the guy who's the guy with the buzz cut and the guy with the goatee. So goatee guy is Chibiga. He posted a picture on Facebook under the name, his cover name, Ruslan Bashirov, which showed him near the astronomical clock in Old Town Square in Prague. And it was very bizarre because it's just like an empty profile. He's like, you know, this is where I work, which is like some like fake place he worked. Here's my high school and here's my name, Ruslan Bashirov. And he's a picture of Old Town Square, which is kind of strange. And there's like one like on the photo and it's some Ukrainian woman. I think the Daily Mail got a hold of her back in 2018, 17, a while. And she was saying, like, you know, some guy, I was at a, you know, cafe in Prague, and this guy was hitting me up, was hitting on me. And so I told him, if you want to talk, you know, add me on Facebook, because I don't have, you know, VK or whatever you're on, add me on Facebook. So what he did is he, like, snapped a picture of where he was, because he probably was at a cafe in a tourist place, and then tried to add her on Facebook, because he wanted to chat her up and, you know, whatever. He's married, by the way, so his wife found out about this the same way we all married with a kid, even. So, yeah. So what he did is he, you know, he got a little too worked up and he posted this, you know, he probably thought that, you know, just throw away profile, register this, add the woman, try to, you know, hang out with her in the lead up to the operation. But, you know, like, on one hand, you know, these are big, dangerous, you know, guys, but they're also, you know, just got, he was thinking with his pants, I guess, with, you know, trying to hit this girl up in it from the cafe. Yeah.
Right. Maybe it wasn't fishing. Maybe it was a honey trap.
Yeah, maybe. Right. Maybe, maybe the Ukrainian intelligence set that up. Right.
I know that you have future reporting coming out about this, but I was wondering if maybe you could tease a little bit about what the motives could possibly be for this apparently pretty sizable Russian secret operation to take out an ammunition depot in the Czech Republic.
Right. So there's a lot of stuff going on linked to this guy named Gevrov, who is this Bulgarian arms dealer manufacturer, who he was also subject of an assassination attempt. He was poisoned by some of the same people who were involved in all this stuff we're talking about. He, you know, people involved in both operations. He was poisoned. They didn't succeed. They tried, though, because what happened, he's given some weird conflicting statements, but in short, he had some arms that were in arms depot in Czechia. So this is a Bulgarian arms manufacturer. He was selling stuff to, going to sell some stuff to Ukraine, to the Ukrainian government. And the idea, no one knows exactly what the goal was for the explosion, but some people think, you know, blow it up on the spot, you know, that's why you have six people there who make sure it all goes off correctly. But also, these guys aren't the most competent ever. You know, they have these failed assassinations. You know, the guy clearly got, you know, opened the Facebook account to shout out the girl. You know, they're not the most careful. So some people think that this is supposed to explode in transit on the way to Ukraine, or maybe if it stops over in Bulgaria, stops there too. You know, maybe they were just supposed to blow up there in Czechia, because maybe, you know, they were trying to make a statement of, you know, don't sell the stuff to Ukraine, whatever. And yeah, so it's kind of shady, because he has made a lot of conflicting statements about, this is the Bulgarian arms dealer, about what he was doing. You know, he's given some very shifty statements about, like, I've not sold any weapons that originated in the Czech Republic to sell to Ukraine. But, like, well, yeah, they didn't started in the Czech Republic. That's just where they were, you know, kind of the layover before they went to Ukraine. So he's made some kind of shifty statements about this. And so we think that's probably the something related to this, you know, kind of as a, he was one of the, you know, he may have been going around some EU and US sanctions of selling some of these weapons in the way he did. He did kind of a roundabout way. And Russia may have, this is again, the early days of the war, right? This is October 2014, right? You know, right when things were heating up after the summer. So this could have been, you know, maybe it was a statement of, you know, don't mess with, you know, don't, you know, Bulgaria is our backyard. And I guess, you know, Czechia is our backyard. It's one thing for the, you know, for the Balts to do this because the Balts hate us already. It's one thing for the UK or the US to do it. But, you know, for a Bulgarian or from the Czechs to sell arms or give arms to Ukraine, that's, you know, that's, don't do that, right? So it may just been a statement. Maybe it was just the longstanding feud they had with this Bulgarian arms dealer. You know, maybe it was very, very specific. Maybe that, I don't remember what it was, but, you know, maybe the very specific arms they were sending over, something they didn't want, you know, like I think it was like anti-tank stuff or something like that. Yeah, I'm not sure. But for whatever reason, they definitely, you know, they clearly it was important because Averyanov himself flew into Vienna for this. And, you know, they had six different guys who were part of this operation, at least six. So clearly it was a priority for whatever reason it was, but it could just be kind of, you know, disputes among, you know, the elites and arms and all that stuff. But yeah, I don't know exactly why, but it's something related to this.
Вы являетесь, да, сексуальным героем.
That's a state investigator telling Vladimir Metelkin that she found his Instagram account online and thinks he's sexy. Metelkin is one of four Doxa editors now under house arrest in a felony case against the student journal. The investigator's bizarre flirtations were part of an attempt to exert pressure on him during questioning, says Metelkin and his lawyer. To find out more about what's happening here, I spoke to Mstislav Grivachov, another editor at Doxa who described how the publication blends journalism and activism in a way that would make it very difficult to manage all this from abroad. So Doxa is, it was initially a student organization at the Higher School of Economics. And as I understand it, the journal positions itself now as a publication sort of about university life in Russia and the problems of social and humanitarian knowledge. And I've also read that Doxa sort of embraces, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, Doxa embraces a kind of left-wing perspective. And I was wondering if you could kind of explain for listeners, like, what does all that mean? Not just the left-wing stuff, but also like, you know, like if somebody, presumably a lot of the listeners to of this podcast, since it's in English, you know, they're not going to be able to read Doxa. They may have heard about it, hopefully, if they're reading Medusa and so on and other news outlets, but they don't necessarily know, you know, if you were to like go to the website and start reading it, like, what is it? What's it all about? Can you tell me?
While Doxa was starting as this academic humanitarian knowledge journal, it was evolving, and now we could use, I think the magazine would be a bit more appropriate, but maybe a newspaper or some kind of, you know, political media would be more appropriate. That said, I'm not saying that Doxa is political. We could say that, you know, the medium in the political spectrum of our editors is left-leaning, but still you couldn't really see that in our coverage because we try our best to fit the journalistic, you know, objectivity status when we're covering our things.
So in terms of Doxa's coverage, what exactly are you writing? I know lately, especially, you've been writing a lot about, you know, your own case, and we'll be getting to that. But is it entirely coverage of pressure that students face in Russian universities, or is it also just coverage of like scholarly studies? Like what exactly, what's the material that appears?
So this thing all started when we started to see some injustice, first of all, in Higher School of Economics. We've seen some examples of harassment by the, you know, by some lecturers and tutors at the university. And we were starting to get some coverage, and Doxa started to become more, you know, renowned back in maybe 2019. And then we started getting messages about similar cases happening in universities across Russia. And we started covering that. And so then we started to make some investigations covering this. We started cooperating with other prominent Russian media, for example, iStories. We managed to do a really good investigative journalism or using data science with them. Some other, Novaya Gazeta, for example, was our partner for a long time. So yeah, in this regard, we started to be, I think we could call ourselves maybe the main media in Russia covering student academia and teachers' problems, and not just, you know, students, but also teachers' problems, because we're covering, for example, also the, how we say it, the union strikes in the UK happening for the last 2 years. As you could see, like last year it was really intense, but the COVID, you know, messed up a lot of things. So yeah, we're covering not just the students' problems, but of course, during the last years, it wasn't our desire, but the political team shifts so rightly. So it was the students, mostly, but not just the students, who were receiving the, who needed to receive the coverage we were trying to, you know, give them.
And so skip ahead to earlier this month on April 14th, the Moscow Police Department, or I guess, I don't know if it was specifically Moscow cops, but it was law enforcement in Moscow. They raid Doxa's newsroom and the homes of four different editors who are now under what is effectively house arrest. They can't go outside and they can't use the internet, pending felony charges that could actually send them to prison for as many as actually 3 years, as I understand it. And the case apparently concerns some video that Doxa released on January 23rd ahead of what were going to be the latest protests, you know, in support of Alexei Navalny, who at the time was already, I think, being held in pretrial detention or something like that. And officials in Moscow, they now say that this amounts to inciting young people to attend an unpermitted rally. You know, this is like a common charge they bring against many members of the media and members of the opposition. Can you tell me, like, what happened here exactly? Like, what was this video, and how did these raids go down?
So I think I'll start with the January the 23rd.
Yeah.
A week before the protest of January 24th, they were announced first by the foundation, by the anti-corruption foundation, you know, the organization that, you know, that was founded by Alexei Navalny. And they announced these protests. And they announced this protest on the week, at the end of the week, at Saturday. And then we were starting to get messages. We were starting to get messages to our bot in Telegram from different students from different universities across Russia, facing lots of oppression and a lot of, you know, sudden changes in schedule they were facing from the universities. For example, some of them were fairly plainly speaking that they are the students who would attend these protests could face sanctions from, you know, losing their academic practice, from losing their, you know, career perspectives, up to being excluded from the university, from being expelled. So yeah, so it was a bit different, but we were getting these messages. And then right before the protest, Doxa published the video, 1.5 minute video, where four of our editors are urging these students not to be intimidated by the actions of these administrations of these universities, because they are illegal, because we have a constitution that we have a right to go on the streets and protest peacefully. And of course, if these, you know, actions from the universities, they were anti-constitutional.
And what about Doxa's future? I mean, if these four editors end up, you know, in prison for 3 years, that's the maximum penalty here, which is, I mean, it sounds insane. It sounds very extreme. Does the journal plan to continue operating? And if so, you know, what kind of safety measures will the staff take? Like, I know that with Navalny's movement, which is also facing a high degree of persecution and legal prosecution and so on, some of their chief people have now just fled abroad, and they're now, you know, they're in self-exile, essentially. Is that something that you're discussing at Doxa? I mean, is it going to be dangerous to have your own staff in Russia?
It is tricky, because I'm not sure whether, like, a media about Russia could operate while being in another country. And so we could see examples of, like, different prominent people in Russia. I wouldn't say fleeing, but, you know, just, you know, moving out of the country to save themselves. And they would lose this connection with Russia. They were still experts, and they were still nice people to hear about. You could saw this gap, and you could see that they're not following as much as they would follow being in this country. So I wouldn't say we're considering going out. I would say no. I'd say that even before, like, the arrest, we had a quite strict protocol on, you know, on safety, and we are enlarging and we're extending the measures in it. And we are, I think we're pretty much, we were quite ready in this regard. We weren't ready, you know, in our minds, but the procedures were in, and we're still, I think, we're still ready. I think talking about the editors right now on house arrest, I don't have the expertise to assess, but we are thinking that the jail thing is quite unlikely, considering none of those editors have any, legal baggage around them. They don't have any, I would say...
prior convictions.
Yeah, prior convictions, yeah. Prior criminal records. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's quite unlikely. And many editors at Dr. Don are convinced that this is just a measure to intimidate our media and some other independent media in Russia. So, yeah, I think we're just continuing our work and we're not planning to go out or something. I think actually after this case, many editors who weren't as engaged with the things we're doing, they became so, and like the amount of time we spent in Doxa since last week, it doubled, tripled, maybe fourfold. So that it was immense. It was a great run and it still is.
Does a lot of the work that you're doing now, does it involve going out into the field and actually speaking to people face to face? Are you mostly kind of collecting reports from students, online? Because I guess when you say you think it'd be difficult to do doxa from abroad, I wonder, does that mean that you're actually going out physically on foot a lot? Or is it mostly kind of working with materials that come to you through the internet?
It is an interesting question. Yeah, I think in our investigative journalism, it is both, and I am a witness of both methods. Of course, in some data examples, we were working from our laptops, but I'd still say that being here is still an immense part of what we're doing. We are, for example, when we are collecting, letters in support of some kind of activist student guy, in this regard, Doxa is in part a journalistic media, but in part an activist organizations, and not a political one, I would underline, because we were just trying to protect the rights of students who go into us. We're not going with a political statement. We're not saying we are supporting, Alexei Navalny. Mm-hmm. We're just against the things that the government is right now doing with him. And we think this is illegal, but it doesn't mean that we are, we will vote for him in the elections. So, yeah, so it's a bit tricky. And this, of course, goes on towards how a certain person defines what is political and what is not.
Right.
But, at the end of the day, I think being here is essential for what Doxa is doing.
On the final segment of today's show, I thought we'd close out with a look at the conditions in Russian prisons, where opposition politician Alexei Navalny just concluded his hunger strike after about 3 weeks, but remains incarcerated, obviously, for the next 2 years and change. To get a sense of what it's like behind bars in Russia, the Naked Pravda welcomes back Ksenia Runova, a junior researcher at the Institute for the Rule of Law at the European University at St. Petersburg. The most stereotypical, I think, assumption is that nothing much has changed since the Gulag, and that, you send somebody to a Russian prison and they're essentially always being sent to Siberia. They have a big fur cap on and they're chopping lumber or something like that. Like, that's the kind of epitome of, I think, the Americans' expectation of Russian prison. It's that it's basically, one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich or something like that.
I should say that the most Russian convicted people, they in corrective colonies. It's colonies in some sense the same to colonies in the Gulag. There are large rooms from 50 to 100 people, but only about 40% of male prisoners work. This is different from Gulag, which was connected with forced labor and very hard conditions on this labor works. 40% is not a very large number, and unemployment is connected to a lack of production orders, low qualification of prisoners, low wages, and motivation to work. And also, we should say that prison system in Russia become more humanitarian. They have more rights, actually. For example, they can receive visits from their relatives and even long-term visits, up to 3 days with their spouse or close relatives. And also they can get food packages and And only 1% of inmates in Russia were most gray crimes, and they placed in prisons. The most prisoners in colonies, and only 1% in prisons, where they live in small cells and have less rights. And also we have the lowest security level facilities, such as penal settlements and correctional centers. Correctional centers is for the sentence for compulsory work. 6% penal settlements are organized as dormitories, but inmates can leave the facility and live with their families inside some territory, but not in the colony.
And how does medical treatment at a penal colony compare to the care that Russians can get at civilian hospitals?
Formerly, the medical staff of correctional facilities and prison hospitals don't obey the head of the facility. They report to a head doctor, and they have own medical chain of subordination. However, in practice, doctors continue to work in conditions of informal subordination of the prison administrations. Therefore, they may not always work independently in the best interest of the patient. For example, it's difficult to save medical confidentiality. Correctional officer may be present when the doctor communicates with the patient, for example.
What about hunger strikes? Are they very typical in Russian prisons? And like, how do they usually end after they've begun?
Prisoners choose hunger strike in cases when other instruments of protection, their rights didn't work. They want to either change living conditions and the prison officer's attitude, stop violence against them, or protest against court decision or authorities. A prison administration doesn't work to attract the attention of the respective regional prison service department, prosecutor's officer, human rights defenders, and the media. Therefore, they can offer the prisoners something in exchange for ending the hunger strike. The same is true for other forms of self-harm. If the administration of facility can fulfill a requirement or offer something in return, and it doesn't cost too much, a hunger strike can be effective in this case. However, if we're talking about political prisoners, then the rules are different here, and in many cases, the administration of correctional facility cannot fulfill the requirement. For political prisoners, the main thing is to draw attention to the problem. A hunger strike helps to do this, and because of that, it's effective too.
Since Navalny's kind of the reason for talking about conditions in prisons right now, he's been putting out statements regularly. And so one of the questions that I've had, and others I think have had as well, is how do inmates like Navalny maintain ties with the outside world while they're incarcerated? I know that he's able to meet with his lawyer every now and then. Is that his only connection to the outside world, or are inmates like in his position, do they have other ways of talking to people?
Navalny is not a typical inmate. He has great support of people, lawyers, human rights defenders, and so on. Most of the prisoners do not have this kind of support. The main agents who help to keep in touch with the outside world for prisoners, relatives and lawyers, they try to get visits, communicate with them by phone or emails on some other tools. Members of public monitoring commissions also inform the public about prisoners and about political prisoners too, but some of them associated with the prison system. For example, they used to work there, and therefore they can conceal information. And yeah, I think that in most cases, political inmates have the opportunity to communicate with their lawyers and relatives with the visits or phone calls or something like that, and emails. But sometimes they hide from the public, and they can be located placed to the isolators and the, how to say cells, very small cells, punishment cells, and they, in these cells, they have an opportunity to speak, to communicate with their lawyers and relatives. But they are in most political inmates, they are in more, they are protected in, because they have this opportunity to show their problems to public and to media, and media want to share this information with public. And, but regular, typical prisoners, they have not such opportunity, and they in danger in larger degree.
You've been listening to The Naked Pravda, an English language podcast from Medusa. On today's show, you heard from Bellingcat Research and Training Director Eric Toller about Russian military intelligence agents' apparent involvement in a covert operation in the Czech Republic. Then I spoke to Mstislav Grivachov, an editor at Doxa, about a felony case against the student journal. And finally, I asked Ksenia Runova, a junior researcher at the Institute for the Rule of Law at the European University at St. Petersburg, about living conditions behind bars in Russia, where Alexei Navalny is spending his time these days. The Naked Pravda is a podcast from Medusa. It's our only English language show. And next week, gee gosh, we might just talk about Russia's law on foreign agent media outlets, just for the fun of it. Anyway, this is Kevin Rothrock, hoping you'll recommend us to your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in to help put this program in front of more people. Thanks for listening, and come back soon.